This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder,
Trump has sent his paramilitary forces into Portland and has promised to send them into a number of other cities, including Chicago. In Chicago, a coalition of progressive lawyers supporting the coalition of organizations demonstrating against racist police abuse have brought a lawsuit. We've interviewed two of the attorneys involved in the lawsuit, Flint Taylor and Christian Snow.
We'll have an update on the financial situation of the United States Postal Service. The new Postmaster General is instituting a series of changes that many say are recasting the Postal Service as a business rather than a government agency. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
With less than 100 days to go before the November elections, Donald Trump is afraid, with good reason, that he's going to get beat. He had planned to run on the strength of the American economy, but because of the widespread and spreading COVID-19 virus and the attendant tanking of the economy, he can no longer do this. Trump has switched election strategies. He calls himself a war president and is hoping to stir up people's fear of anarchists and socialists, people who he says hate our country and who he falsely claims are tearing it apart in rising crime-ridden, Democratic-controlled major cities. Fear is his strategy. He won the last election despite losing the popular vote by raising the specter of fear of Muslim terrorists and Mexican rapists and murderers invading our southern borders. Using the pretext of an executive order issued to protect statues and monuments, Trump has marshaled paramilitary troops from six different federal organizations, including Homeland Security and the Customs and Border Patrol. 2 weeks ago, he sent them to Portland, Oregon, where there were largely peaceful demonstrations going on. The military forces were sent out to crush the demonstrators, to, in Trump's words, dominate the streets. Dressed in camouflage uniforms and without identification, they plucked protesters off the streets, kidnapped and interrogated them, and then released them. They used tear gas, pepper spray, and fired rubber bullets. They beat people severely with batons and focused their attacks on paramedics, National Lawyers Guild legal observers, and journalists. Trump has indicated that he plans to send his paramilitary troops to Chicago. Black Lives Matter in that city and several other activist organizations have banded together and sued Trump to prevent this. We speak today with Flint Taylor. He's the founding partner of the People's Law Office. Taylor's litigated against police abuse in Chicago for over 50 years. He started out successfully representing the family of the assassinated Black Panther leader Fred Hampton. He has represented many victims of police torture and has written the award-winning book, The Torture Machine, Racism and Violence in Chicago. We also speak with attorney Christian Snow, who is an associate of the Chicago Civil Rights Law Office, the People's Law Office. She's a leader of the prison abolitionist group, Asada's Daughters, and has been active in the Black Lives Matter movement in Chicago, protesting the racist murder of George Floyd. Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be back once again. Flint, on July 23rd, you and other attorneys in Chicago representing Black Lives Matter and other organizations in your city filed a lawsuit to prevent Trump's paramilitary from what, quote, Trump says, dominating the city of Chicago, like they attempted to do in Portland. Who are the plaintiffs in your lawsuit, and who are you representing?
Yes, the lead plaintiff is Black Lives Matter Chicago, but there is a wide group of organizations, youth organizations, spanning from Black Lives Matter and the Abolitionist Network to Democratic Socialists of America, the National Lawyers Guild, and In These Times magazines, and there's several other local organizations as well. The lawyers are also a coalition of left and liberal lawyers in the city, including the Lovey and Lovey firm, the Mandel Legal Clinic, the Community Justice and Civil Rights Clinic at Northwestern, and the Westside Justice Center, and of course the People's Law Office.
Who are you suing? Who are the defendants?
Well, the defendants, the named defendants that everyone will recognize is Wolf of Homeland Security and none other than the notorious Bill Barr. But the agencies being sued include the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, FBI, the ATF, and the Federal Protection Service.
By what authority does Trump claim he can send paramilitary forces into
your
city of
Chicago?
Well, you know, Trump never is clear, and he never has the backing of the Constitution or law when he does the kinds of things that he does. I think he originally in Portland was claiming that they were protecting federal properties, which was the pretext he used there. And the pretext that seems to be floating around Chicago is that it's there to help quell violence in the communities, which is, you know, a euphemism for invading the African-American communities where there's been quite a bit, unfortunately, of violence recently. But unfortunately, also here in the city of Chicago, we have a former prosecutor, federal prosecutor, as our mayor. And she, on the one hand, is very blustery with regard to Trump and telling him that he can't overstep his bounds. On the other hand, she's conceded that the feds could come in here, but she's trying to say that they're here only to help the police investigate crimes, federal crimes, such as gun laws and drug laws and that kind of thing. That's where it stands at the present moment here in Chicago.
When you say violence, you mean violence connected to the demonstrations or violence in the community?
Well, that's a good question. So far, the way the mayor is construing it is it's violence in the community. There was a string of murders and shootings, and there has been a rise in the homicide rate here in the city. And, of course, the cops are completely ineffectual in being able to arrest anybody or investigate the cases because the community doesn't trust them. What they're doing is beefing up the federal presence in criminal investigations, but everybody is more than suspicious that it's going to flow over into the streets at a moment's notice, and that the lawsuit is about trying to protect the First and Fourth Amendments from the kinds of unlawful and unconstitutional rampage that the federal agents are and were perpetrating in Portland.
Well, we all know what the First Amendment allows you to do. What about the Fourth Amendment?
Well, we see in Portland that not only are these camouflaged agents of whatever agency they may be, without name tags and without identification, have been snatching people up off the street and putting them into vans, beating them, tear gassing them. Of course, that kind of activity is all Fourth Amendment protected. The First Amendment protections, of course, are prospective as well, because people here and these groups, as courageous as they are, committed as they are to come out to continue to demonstrate, it certainly has a chilling effect not only on the ones that do come out, but the folks that decide not to come out because of the fact that the federal invasion looms over the heads of the protesters, and they seen what they did to not only young demonstrators in Portland, but also veterans with the Navy T-shirts on, and how they took baseball bats to him, and that's the kind of thing that the Chicago police have already been doing here, but these Fed agents seem to be the Chicago police and the police across this country on steroids, and so that's why the group of lawyers and plaintiffs got together here and filed this lawsuit seeking declaratory and injunctive relief.
What did the Trump people in Portland do specifically to legal observers and medics and journalists and the leaders of the demonstrations?
Well, the pattern that they had there is the same as the patterns that we saw from the police in those and other cities across the country. And they do target those folks. And the kinds of selective beatings and gassings and incommunicado picking up of people is the kind of selective brutality and selective unconstitutionality that, in the same way, in a very different kind of context, murdering Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in their beds was not only a tremendously violent and vicious act by the federal and local governments here in Chicago, but it was symbolic in the way to show everybody concern, and particularly the leadership, how to what lengths the government will go to repress dissent and to repress the right to speech and to repress, in this instance, the kinds of things that are being asked for in terms of respect for black lives and defunding the police and that kind of cry that's the focus of the demonstrations here and across the country. And what this also does is to deflect the focus of the demonstrators and their message to Trump and his politics and his desperation in the election and the other things that are clearly what Trump is all about here and what he's doing in threatening and actually implementing stormtroopers coming to the cities of this country.
We're speaking with civil rights attorney Flint Taylor in Chicago. Flint, tell us about the injunction that you're seeking against the Trump paramilitary. What's the status of your lawsuit, and what are your next steps?
Well, the case asks for declaratory relief. It's asking for First and Fourth Amendment declaratory relief to declare that the government cannot restrain the plaintiff's ability to assemble in peaceful protest, a declaration that the federal actions in this described in this complaint, meaning the actions in Portland and projected into Chicago, are federally unlawful policy of committing arrests without probable cause and the violation of the Fourth Amendment, and other declarations along those lines, and then seeks an injunction to stop and make the government refrain from the kinds of activities involving themselves in protests and in unlawfully arresting and detaining and beating and gassing and all that kind of activity that hasn't happened here in Chicago yet, but is threatened by Trump and threatened by Chris Wolf and all of those folks. And he has said that the agents are somewhere here in Chicago doing we don't know what yet, because this weekend we didn't see evidence of these officers on the streets. But, of course, they don't always identify themselves. And where they might be lurking and what they might be doing is something that has to be curbed.
Flint Taylor, I'm going to ask you about your observations with respect to what Juan Cole has recently written. Cole said that it now appears clear that part of their strategy is to send federal agents dressed like Iraq war troops to Democratic-run cities on the pretext of protecting federal property, and then for them to attack and provoke Black Lives Matters and defend the police protesters, defund the police protesters, causing violence to escalate and using it to scare the white suburbs into voting for Trump. How do you appreciate what Cole just observed?
Well, I think Cole is saying something that we all who have been around for many years and observed the political scene, particularly as it deals with, quote, law and order and racism and white supremacy, that this is out of the playbook of Karl Rove, and this is out of the playbook of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. This is out of the playbook of Reagan. This is out of the playbook of Bush and Willie Horton. Bush the First, that this is when the Republicans get scared about their prospects to in elections, or even when they don't. They use that kind of racism and white supremacy to fan the flames of their base, and that's what Trump is doing. He hopes that he can move the needle with regard to the polls that show him badly losing in the election coming up by fanning racism. And he's shown to be a racist and a white supremacist through the entire 4 years, and now he's activating his beliefs and what he's done very focused right now, as Juan Cole described it, in terms of what he's doing and what he's trying to accomplish. We can only hope that the American populace and the white folks that he's appealing to will reject this approach and be better than they have been in the past during other administrations in terms of who they vote for and what they understand is going on. And I think more white folks in the targeted areas that Trump is trying to fan up, more of them now have a better understanding that black lives do matter, and that hopefully that this tactic, like his other tactics, will fail. And that he will not be able to divide completely into what white supremacists want, which is a race war.
How can people learn about your work and the work of the People's Law Office, and particularly about this lawsuit that you've brought in Chicago?
Well, they can certainly go on our website, and we've tried to keep it up to date with the kind of historical documents and the current work that we've done. We also, our lawyers have written several books about our work. I've written a book called The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. Our partner Jeff Haas has written a book about the assassination of Fred Hampton. And Joey Mogul has also written, co-authored a book on her work. That is some of the ways that people can learn more about our work and what we think and what we and how we're focused in terms of our anti-racist and work in the city of Chicago and across the country.
Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office. Flint, thank you so much for being our guest, our returning guest on Law and Disorder. Good luck to you on the lawsuit. We'll be checking in with you, and let's hope that we can cover a victory. You take it easy, Flint.
You too, Michael. Thanks.
Now we go to attorney Christian Snow. Christian, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, it's good to be able to talk to you, Christian. Christian, when Martin Luther King marched in Chicago in the 60s, he was met by ferocious hostility. What's the difference now?
I would say, you know, this moment right now is still a really intense moment, as it was when King came through Chicago in the 60s. The confluence of the government's response to COVID-19 and the economic suffering of folks, as well as the continued racial violence of the state against black folks, especially in this city, has made for a moment where the tension has resulted in folks deciding that once again enough is enough, and having an opportunity to take to the streets, or think that it's important enough to have their voices heard, their demands heard, to take the streets in unity, to demand from the state that they rectify the situation and end the violence against them. And so, you know, the timing now is different because of the context of the situation, and it's a time where a lot of people are starting to recognize things need to change, and folks who have been fighting for those changes for a long time have an opportunity to continue.
Talk about the black leadership of the demonstrations and about the participation of white people in the demonstrations.
Yes, well, Chicago is a city that's deeply rooted. Its history is deeply rooted in organizing and activism. I always love to say that Chicago has an organizing ecosystem that has been led by black folks of a myriad of backgrounds for a long time. And, you know, that leadership is starting to be recognized, just like the leadership of young people is starting to be recognized as something that's critical and crucial to not entrenching or not furthering or pushing for efforts that would just deepen and exacerbate the oppression that folks are facing. I think people have been learning and studying over the past few years especially, but over the last few decades, and understanding that Black leadership has always had an eye towards what we truly need to implement in order to achieve liberation and collective liberation. And I think it's a beautiful time right now for all folks, in particular white folks, to be studying and organizing themselves and, you know, taking to the streets with an understanding that their liberation is tied to all of our liberation. And so this moment is beautiful in the sense that that's visible, and, you know, white folks are willing to be the agitators in the situation. But there has always been a multiracial coalition of folks pushing for collective liberation, and I think that we're just able to see it better in this moment, and that there are more folks in this moment who are taking up that call to action.
Christian Snow, I wanted to ask you about the demands of the demonstrators. There's considerable support in Chicago for community control of the police, and that's different from cutting back on the police budget, isn't it?
I would think that they are part of the same push. The end goal for a lot of folks here in Chicago, but especially for folks who are students of policing, is the abolition of policing, surveillance, criminalization, and all other forms of anti-Blackness, as we recognize police and prisons to be manifestations of anti-Blackness. And so there are folks who are pushing for more immediate reforms, which include community control of the police. But then there are folks who are also pushing simultaneously for the broader end goal, which is the defunding of police forces and the abolition of police in their entirety, as we build towards that, as we build towards a system of community accountability.
Attorney General Bill Barr testified last week before Congress that the paramilitary troops they sent to Portland and they promised to send to Chicago are necessary because the demonstrations there are violent and they're led by what he calls agitators and anarchists and socialists. What's been your experience in Chicago?
Well, my experience in Chicago has been one of state violence. I've been a daughter of the west side of the city for, I guess, since birth at this point. State violence has always been clear and present. And it's interesting that folks see state violence as something that is acceptable, but see the defense of communities who are under attack by state violence as something unacceptable. Here, we recognize that state violence solves no problems. In fact, it exacerbates problems, and that their goal is not to liberate or free us, but their goal is to further imprison us through state violence. Violence, particularly from the state, should never be used to protect property over lives, and it should never be used against the people that they say that they are accountable to, and it should never be deployed to protect the ruling class. State violence is not something we should ever tolerate, whether it is here in Chicago or here in Illinois or here in the United States or abroad. State violence is never necessary. It is only necessary as a tool of the oppressors to keep us in prison and not one that's utilized as a freedom mechanism. And so we reject state violence and all of its manifestations because we understand that its only purpose is to further anti-Blackness and further imprisonment of all oppressed people. And we take a stand against that in its varied form.
Christian Snow, you're a leader of the organization Daughters of Asida. Talk about that group, please. What is its mission?
Yes, the organization's name is Asada's Daughters, and we are a grassroots Black woman-led, Black youth-focused organization that is focused on and pushing for the deepening, escalation, and sustainability of the Black liberation movement by providing a well of youth leadership who can hold down the movement and push it forward. We believe in providing political education, revolutionary support, organizing training, and leadership development to young Black people here in Chicago so that they can participate in, learn and organize in, and guide the movement forward, as has been the tradition of Black young people since the 1900s.
How can people learn more about Asada's Daughters?
Folks can go to our website, asadasdaughters.org. They can follow us on Twitter, at Asada's Daughters. They can also find us on Facebook, at Asada's Daughters. And they can, you know, just come around out to the protests and out to the demonstrations and meet some of our young people who are guiding us forward.
That's A-S-S-A-T-A. Christian, I'd like to ask you, what would you like to see the current movement develop into? What's your vision of the future?
Yes, well, we have no idea what this current wave of uprisings will bring. We are in a moment like we have never seen before, one where there's beautiful opportunity to push forward some radical demands that end in the abolition of policing, as we know it and see it, and all of its potential future manifestations. We can call on the state to recognize their role in our lives is not as our jailers or imprisoners, and that their pushing forward of anti-Blackness will no longer stand. We can see police leave schools. We can see police leave neighborhoods. We can see cameras and surveillance of neighborhoods come down. We can see the destruction of gang databases and bring back the freedom of association. We can see community control and accountability. We can see communities who continue to work to keep us safe and discover new ways to build out a community where we all have what we need and are free. In this moment, almost anything is possible, and I'm truly looking forward to seeing what the movement produces.
Well said, Christian Snow. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to speaking with you again in the future and for some more optimistic reports. So thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck and take it easy.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Quick update here. Since we recorded this interview, the American Post Workers Union's president has warned that recently enacted Postal Service procedures, which have led to nationwide delays in mail delivery, could also affect mail-in voting for the November election. Mark Diamonstein told CNN that postal workers and customers are reporting that mail delivery has slowed and, quote, degraded. The union leader says it's been demoralizing and upsetting to workers who have worked through the pandemic. The new procedures, including cutting overtime, come from Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a longtime Donald Trump supporter and fundraiser. Bins of mail ready for delivery have been left sitting in post offices due to scheduling and route changes, and carriers are sorting more mail themselves, increasing delivery times. As Trump trails Joe Biden in the polls, he now claims that delays processing mail-in votes would undermine the legitimacy of the November election and has suggested delaying it. Let's go now to this interview.
In late May, we reported that the United States Postal Service was projected to run out of funds by September 2020. New forecasts, however, give the USPS a few more months. But without long-term reform from Congress, it's likely to still run out of cash before the end of 2021. Since May, the USPS has a new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. He's a major donor to President Donald Trump and has already imposed a plan to cut costs, whereby mail deliveries could be delayed by a day or more, a move that could impact election mail-in ballot results. Representative Carolyn Maloney, who chairs a government operations subcommittee of the Committee on Oversight and Reform, underscored this potential result. Quote, "While these changes in a normal year would be drastic, in a presidential election year when many states are relying heavily on absentee mail-in ballots, increases in mail delivery timing would impair the ability of ballots to be received and counted in a timely manner. An unacceptable outcome for a free and fair election." DeJoy's appointment has raised several concerns about his qualifications and about potential ethics problems. He's the first person in decades to lead the Postal Service with no experience as a letter carrier, and his background raises potential financial conflicts of interests. He and his wife own $30.1 million to $75.3 million in assets in Postal Service competitors or contractors, such as UPS and the trucking company J.B. Hunt. Joining us to discuss these developments is Chuck Zlatkin. Chuck is the legislative director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union. Chuck, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Heidi, for having me back to talk about the situation with the Postal Service.
Chuck, what happened to put the post office in a situation where they're going to run out of money?
Okay, well, the way the post office is designed and the way it's been functioning since 1971 as an independent government agency is that it's self-sufficient from the sale of stamps and services. It's designed basically to fund itself, and it has done so, not receiving any government funds. But again, because it receives its revenue from sales of stamps and services, when something like the pandemic crisis comes along, where it really sets back the use of the mail business, falling off, estimated anywhere between 30% and 50% of the revenue is gone because people are just not using mail during this period. Therefore, there's a subsequent loss of income that's going to be coming. It's just a question of determining when it was going to run out of money. And initially, the outgoing Postmaster General thought it might have been as early as September, but the way things have fallen with the extreme use of package delivery and some recovery in the economy, now they're saying that Postal Service will be good probably till March of 21, at which time it will then run out of funds.
Some people view shutting down the post office as a way to stop mail ballots that would favor Biden in the upcoming presidential race. What is your view about this?
Well, we say some people, the biggest proponent against mail, voting by mail, is President Trump. Anything that he views that can help his chances, I guess he's in favor of. So, yes. What should have happened immediately with the new Postmaster General coming in and the fact that we're facing what looks to be an ongoing pandemic that will impact right into the November election, the Postal Service should have started preparing for an increase in mail volume based on voting by mail and to be ready for it. So I would assume that if the new Postmaster General was concerned about this, he would have called in his management of people from the states where they already have voting by mail as mandatory in Washington State, Colorado, and Oregon, and say, well, what have we learned? How do we deal with this? How do we make sure everyone receives their ballots and the ballots are returned in time? So it's not that there isn't a track record or history to go by. But from what we've seen that the new Postmaster General is dealing with, he doesn't even seem to be concerned about voting by mail or the post office being able to deal with that. So that's very alarming to people because, you know, it shouldn't be a question of people deciding, well, will I maintain my health or vote? They should be able to do both.
Just tell us, if you will, briefly about the new Postmaster General. He succeeded Megan Brennan. What's the reaction been thus far, especially by members of the Postal Union?
Okay, well, in a sense, you know, you always have a tendency to want to give someone the benefit of the doubt and give them a chance to see what they're going to do and not just be against them based on their business history or their anti-union, anti-worker behavior in the past. But Louis DeJoy hasn't given us much of a chance. It's not even that he's already alienated the unions by not engaging them or discussing the changes he's implementing, but the fact is he's already alienated members of Congress. I mean, the ranking chair of the Homeland Security Committee sent him a letter on the 17th, and the leadership of the House Committee also sent him a letter detailing all the concerns they're having. All right, look at it from his point of view. He's coming in. Who does he please? Does he please the 159 million people who receive a mail delivery every day? Is he concerned of the 600,000 employees who work for the Postal Service? Is he concerned about the millions of people who rely on the Postal Service for delivery of medications? Are those the people he's trying to engage with and be involved with? Or is he out to just please one person, and that's the President of the United States? So what he's done, he's come in, and the Postal Service, through the pandemic, even though they had to deal with all kinds of, you know, financial problems, have demonstrated once again to the American public how important and reliable the Postal Service is. So the recent, you know, Pew poll had the Postal Service at a 91% approval rating, the highest rated by far of any government agency. And the Harris poll did a poll to people on companies that they could rely on, the companies that they found most essential during the pandemic. And of the 100 companies that were polled, the number one, first in the view of the American people, is the Postal Service. So here he comes in with getting rave reviews for his agency during this pandemic, people understanding the importance of the Postal Service and the dedication of postal workers. And the first thing he does is, or surreptitiously, because he hasn't done it publicly, he hasn't gone to any of the agencies or the Senate or the House or the, but what we gather, even the Postal Regulatory Commission or the Postal Board of Governors, and he already starts talking about instituting service cuts. There was a PowerPoint that was actually leaked to the Washington Post and some other publications, and a stand-up talk to be given to the workers, telling them that from now on there's going to be a change, there's going to be a pivot in the way we deal with the mail, that we're going to not be concerned about getting the mail out as much as we are going to be about, you know, staying on time, not having any extra costs for truck trips or overtime or whatever. So that's what, so the joy in came in on June 15th, and in just about a month, he's already shown that he doesn't care about the employees, the customers, the people who have oversight over his agency, either Postal Board of Governors or the Postal Regulatory Commission, or the unions that he's supposed to negotiate with and deal with. It's shocking how quickly he's managed to let people know where he's coming from. There's no pretense whatsoever about him maintaining the Postal Service during the pandemic that's still going on, where people have demonstrated how much they depend upon the Postal Service. He's talking about cutting back service. So that's Louis DeJoy, who did say it was an extensive search that went around the country to get him. But in reality, he's, you know, a fundraiser and crony of Trump going back for years, and he seems to be that he's serving a constituency of one and the hell with the people who depend upon the Postal Service, work for the Postal Service, or are responsible for the Postal Service.
Steve Bannon, Trump's ideological advisor, has said he wants to, quote, illuminate the administrative state. Do you think closing down the post office is an aspect of this extreme view?
I'm not that good at analyzing Steve Bannon, but I can't even imagine what it would be like to shut back the Postal Service, eliminate what it's going to mean for people. I mean, I don't even want to have to go there. My attitude at this point is for us to do everything possible to stop it, because originally we were dealing with finances, getting the finances for the Postal Service to get through this pandemic period to keep existing and serving the public. But now it appears that the Postmaster General, and maybe he's, you know, maybe he has coffee with Steve Bannon, I don't know, but he's going ahead and cutting back service. It makes no sense, but I know that the Postal Service is an important part of the economy. It's there that people depend upon it.
What would it look like if the post office were to shut down?
I don't even want to think about it, because it would be such a horrific thing for the economy, for people who depend upon the Postal Service. I mean, the Postal Service delivers 1.2 billion medical prescriptions annually. That's people get their 30-day supplies, but it's not, you know, 30-day supplies of what? Medications that keep them alive, that keep them sane, that keep them from excruciating pain. Is that, how are they going to get that? I mean, that's not just something simple. People who have been getting, you know, supplies and food or whatever it is through the mail, even more so now, besides getting in a pension or paychecks, or getting information from, you know, customers. I mean, it's such an important part of our society and economy, and it really impacts people so, you know, severely, that to eliminate this service at this time during a pandemic, it's outrageous. And the fact that this new Postmaster General, the 75th Postmaster General of the United States, Louis DeJoy, this is what he's doing now. I mean, what do we think of him? I think he should resign. And if he doesn't resign, he should be fired for what he's doing, because he's actively trying to destroy the Postal Service right now, today. He's not waiting. Once you say to people that the Postal Service is not going to be concerned about you getting your mail as quickly as possible, is not going to be concerned about whether it stays another day or two in a facility or a truck or whatever, to cut back on spending, is not competent, is not doing the job they're supposed to be doing. I mean, he took an oath, you know, for this position to, defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, like all the other federal people do. And if anyone comes in there and is trying to destroy the Postal Service, they're attacking this society, and he's leading the attack. I don't know what to tell you. I don't want to think about it, because it would be such a horror for people all across this country if this was to take place. The fact that it's even being considered at a time when you're talking about $25 billion to make up for the shortfall, at a time a number of weeks ago, they were giving out $25 billion to private companies without any commitments to the public at all. It wasn't a problem to give it to private companies, but to give the money to sustain the Postal Service through this period of time that serves millions upon millions of people every day, not for profit, but as a service, it's unbelievable. So yes, the unions have a case against him, and to groups that are involved with a good mail service, but the people have the responsibilities to oversee him and to make judgments on what's being done. He's not following procedure. He's supposed to go to the Postal Board of Governors for major changes like this. The Postal Board of Governors is then supposed to go to the Postal Regulatory Commission and have them do a study and an assessment of what these plans are. He hasn't done that. He just says to the people, you know, we're not paying anyone overtime, we're not sending out trucks, and you just let the mail sit there. That's what he told the employees. As a postal employee myself for 35 years, the first thing you're told when you get your job and you're on the work floor or wherever you're at, that delaying the mail isn't a problem, isn't something you should just avoid doing. Delay of mail is a crime. Delaying the mail is a crime. And what this Postmaster General is saying is that he's saying, I'll act like a criminal because I'm going to delay the mail, trying to hurt the Postal Service, to damage it so it won't be able to continue in what's needed for the American people.
It's a crime, and as you've so eloquently put, it's literally a lifeline to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of persons who rely on it for medication and other vital services. Let's look at one glimmer of good news, I think, namely that the Board of Governors of the Postal Service did approve the $75 billion relief package that former Postmaster General Megan Brennan asked for back in April. What will those funds be used for, Chuck?
Okay, well, I want to be clear. The fact that the Board of Governors unanimously endorsed this money, unfortunately, right, they're not the ones who give it. It has to come through Congress.
Oh, I thought it was approved by Congress. No?
No. All right. What happened was in the CARES package, where they initially approved the $25 billion, and then the administration, Trump and Mnuchin, said, no, we're not going to sign this bill if there's any relief in there for the Postal Service. That they then allowed was a $10 billion loan that once that was passed by Congress and signed by the president after the fact, he then put in stipulations, he and Mnuchin, that before they would lend the money to the Postal Service would have to raise package prices by 400 to 500%, and they would also have to take responsibilities and duties away from the Postal Regulatory Commission and the Board of Governors and give it to the Secretary Treasurer, which it seems like now the Postmaster is taking those powers himself. So that's what happened. No money went to the Post Office in the CARES Act. Then the HEROES Act went through, passed the House. Within that legislation, there's $25 billion for the Postal Service and $10 billion loan. There's also a legislation that was introduced by four senators that was direct aid to the Postal Service for $25 billion, a Senate Bill of 4174, which basically is there specifically to give aid to the Postal Service strictly for coronavirus-impacted finances. And that bill has been introduced on the floor. But right now, the Postal Service has no money coming. Has no money coming unless the Senate decides that they're going to okay something similar to what the House did with the HEROES Act or do something on a standalone bill. Then at that point, it'll still have to go before the president to be signed into law. That's where we're at now. So here it is, you know, well in speeding through July. And we're talking about, you know, running out of money in March and nothing being done to get the money to the Postal Service except pulling back on service to the public, which is what the new Postmaster General, DeJoy, has instituted. So we have two things we're dealing with. One, getting the money for the Postal Service to survive, and then two, having a Postmaster General who would use the money.
Chuck, do you think this is guise for trying to shift business to entities like FedEx or UPS, taking it away from functions that have been so well performed by the USPS for so long into basically a shift to privatization?
I would say very definitely so, that this is what it's all about. Is, you know, privatization, but the privatization that will come about it won't be shifting the postal service does to private companies. It'll be shifting some of what the postal service does to private companies, and then the rest of it'll be people will be abandoned. That they are not going to do what the postal service does, which is guarantee universal delivery to everybody. These companies only want to deliver to where it's profitable, and to have rates done that way to accent their profit. So yes, it is very definitely part of an overall plan, which has picked up speed under this administration, but it didn't start under this administration, to eventually bring about privatization of the postal service because of the amount of money that can be made. Because right now, the postal service is a service, and its money is to pay people a living wage to get people the mail in a timely fashion. It's not there to make profits, and that's what the privatizers want. They want to get their hands on the profits. They don't give a damn about the service to the public. I mean, the outgoing postmaster Brennan, the first female postmaster, I mean, for whatever arguments maybe the unions had with her or whatever, she was committed to a public postal service. She wasn't a privatizer. And while she may have taken her time in making decisions and whatever, she had an open door. She would talk to the unions, that they would work together with the unions in terms of trying to get legislation to benefit the postal service. I don't even know if this postmaster has even met with the unions yet.
Chuck, what is Joe Biden's stance on the post office?
Well, Joe Biden has said that he's for the post office now, and he's very much in favor of keeping the post office going. Of course, if we look back at the previous administrations, Obama-Biden administration wasn't what you would say is necessarily like a post office present administration by their behavior. The legislation that was passed back in 2006, the Postal Accountability Enhancement Act, which was designed to damage the Postal Service, moving towards privatization. I mean, when Obama and Biden were in power in 2009 and had the White House and both houses of Congress, they did nothing to correct that legislation. As a matter of fact, I know because I was working in D.C. during that period of time from 2014 through 16, that the four unions wanted to have a meeting with President Obama, the four union presidents representing 600,000 postal workers. They wouldn't give them a meeting in that period of time at all. And basically, Obama wasn't exactly a progressive when he came to his ideas for the post office. He was all about cutting back service then. So I don't know how much you say Biden was responsible for what took place for his 8 years as vice president and now what he's saying that he's going to do. But at this point, he says that he'll be concerned with keeping the post office going.
Are the United States Postal Service financial forecast scenarios concerning the impact of the COVID pandemic on Postal Service finances, are those currently pretty much up to date?
Well, again, the forecast. Initially, the first forecast was that the volume would have fallen off more and that the package business wouldn't have been as high as it is. But now, I would say it's a lot closer to what things are going to be because, again, how much is the economy going to recover with the latest outgrowth of what's taking place with the virus? How much is that going to impact on the national recovery? Because when the nation recovers, they use the post office more. So at this point, basically what they're saying is that the money should run out. The earliest would be March, and the latest would be the summer. So again, there's some wiggle room there for whatever. But the reality is, until the Postal Service is in a situation where it's dealing with a normal economy, it has to take into consideration these forecasts. And the $25 billion is to make up for the shortfall. The original $75 billion, which was recommended by the Postal Board of Governors and the Postal Regulatory Commission and most people who understand about the role of the Postal Service is, was to deal with the shortfall, was also to do with what they said was shovel-ready projects to modernize the Postal Service. That was the 25 and 25. And the other 25 was to have borrowing authority, if necessary, up to 25. That was the original $75 billion package. Now we're talking about, if the HEROES Act gets through the Senate, we're talking about $25 billion for the shortfall and a $10 billion line of credit. And I guess that's forgetting about modernizing the Postal Service. But that's what we're dealing with. So, again, the projections and where the Postal Service was coming from, postal management was coming from prior to June 15th when DeJoy came over, we would assume that they were making their best aspect to capture what was what they perceived. Now I have no idea what the Postmaster General is demanding of his upper management in terms of what kind of forecasting there'll be or whatever, because he seems to be not concerned about the forecast or the financially. He just wants to cut back on costs by reducing service and reliability of the Postal Service to the American people in the middle of a pandemic. I don't know how you can then extrapolate, well, what the rest of their thinking will be, because this is insane.
Clearly, we have to keep our eyes on this new Postmaster General. These are disturbing updates that you've provided. Chuck, we've run out of time. How can our listeners learn more about what they can do as patrons of our beloved Postal Service?
Okay, well, at this point, I think that a good place to go would be the APWU, that's four letters, .org. Go to that website where there's lots of information, and also that you can sign up to be informed, to get text messages about what's taking place latest, and also a means of getting through and contacting your senators, because we're assuming that this isn't going to be determined in 1 or 2 days, and contacting your senators and saying that you're demanding funding for an essential service, the Postal Service, to survive through the pandemic is something that could be an important thing to do. So that's APWU4letters.org would be a good place to go to get the latest information on what's taking place and actions that people can take and are taking around the country.
Wonderful. Chuck, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. We're going to hopefully stay in touch with you as the situation unfolds in the next few months, but thank you for your excellent work.
Well, thank you very much for having me on and continuing to follow this really essential, what has now become a real crisis.
All right, Chuck, have a great day. Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.